a, fun little cold open.
I mean, as opposed to
what's that?
Killing off your favorite character?
Yeah, as opposed to when you killed Raid, or we could talk about when you killed Raid. That's fine by me too.
So quirkily enough, I don't use bugbears that often. They tend to be a smaller scale, more solitary creature.
Yeah.
And so a lot of times, depending on the environment and where you place them, they don't happen that much.
Yeah.
They've been in the background a few times where they've been either part of a slave camp, running a slave camp.
Yeah.
Part of a goblin horde or something along those lines. But they don't often come into a game as a particularly complex villain, because a lot of times you just don't get to them. And depending on how you're structuring your story, I try to make things realistic. So in the game we ran, the country of Steric in the world of Greyhawk is very close to frontier and wildlands. So yeah. It made sense that bugbears would be a potential problem there. And then they would come in on raiding parties and things like that. But the when these creatures aren't necessarily good when you're playing inside of a kingdom, because kingdoms are well defended, they've been civilized, they would have to be a very specific reason for them to be there.
Not really a whole lot of bugbears just walking around the streets.
No, but surprisingly enough, depending on the lore that you can find about it, they're actually considered to be kind of like boogeymen.
Yeah.
And they're in some of the canon, they're very solitary. So they're not like orcs or goblins, and they don't run around in hordes. They tend to be very small groups or even singular. And it made me think, as I was researching for this, that they would be a very interesting low-level horror persona. Like, you know, the monster in the dark sort of thing.
Yeah.
Or it lives in a cave, or that you have to get something out of, because they're very stealthy. They're not stupid.
They're quite smart.
At least average intelligence by most systems. And in that regard, and you can express that as cleverness. So they don't necessarily need to be rocket scientists or magic users or anything like that. But they can still be quite clever in how they engage in their tactics. And that's kind of what I'm shooting for.
Yeah.
So,
so you're saying something sort of like people tell tales of like, ooh, the creature out in the woods, you know, don't go near this one cave. And that's what you're building around, because it's been like smart enough to set up traps and a small encampment so that it can you know, scare this village into doing what it wants or something like that?
To some degree, yeah. And you could also kind of fill in with rumors and legends. Okay, people go missing in the Darkwood, or occasionally people will see yellow eyes out in the dark. However you want to express that, it becomes possible. And you can even like double up, and maybe they only see one at any one time.
Yeah.
There might be two or three.
There might be a couple of bugbears.
Exactly. And then there's an advantage to the mystery. And so as a DM, how you roll out that mystery to your players can matter, because they have to figure out the mystery in addition to fighting the monster, and they may not have ever encountered a bugbear before. So it also behooves you to create different descriptors to sort of throw people off the scent.
So you're saying even if they know what a bugbear is, or maybe, like you say, they've never encountered a bugbear before, this would be a cool way to like discover what is a bugbear.
Yeah.
To like delve into what makes it different than just like, oh, it's a tall goblin. It's a little bit more than that.
Exactly. And it also depends on how you play these things into the mythology of your game. If everything is just an encounter to be killed, then you really don't have much to work with. You're just playing off stats.
But it's a perfectly fine way to play for some people.
Exactly. None of it's necessarily good or bad. It really depends on whether or not your group is having fun.
Exactly.
But if you're wanting to build a mythology and a mood or a depth to the game that makes people wonder and kind of pulls them in like reading a good book or watching a really good movie. Yeah. It sort of sucks you in. You can do that with gaming too. If you can get people to engage long enough to, you know, take the leap.
Get off your phones. I want to talk about bugbears.
Exactly. And so when that happens, you can use creatures like these very creatively, luring them out into the woods. You know, the pet goes missing first, and then maybe one of the children go missing, and then occasionally somebody sees eyes, lit eyes in the woods.
Yeah.
And they could be yellow, they could be red. Use a color that fits everything, color, texture, tone, whether or not it only comes out on moonless nights, or if it's stormy because it's afraid of something.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. You could also make it like maybe it stole a magical weapon or item. I mean, it's smart enough to be able to recognize the difference between like a, you know, for mechanics sake, a sword and a plus one sword. And that would make it a much more dangerous opponent. Just that small advantage.
Yeah, because
adds lore to it. Like, oh, the blacksmith says he lost his prized family sword that's been sent down from generations.
And they can do that in some of the material I researched for this. They're quite good thieves.
Yeah,
they're large thieves. they're not crawling through drains or anything like that.
Yeah,
but they're quite adept at that type of thing, and you can easily pull that into your game. And they can be a superlative villain. Now, one of the things I did with you in our my little bugbear raiding parties.
Yeah. Let's talk about that. So this was actually the first time I'd ever experienced a bugbear was when you did this. And I had never heard of this was a few years ago, but I'd never heard of a bugbear before. And so when you first said that, I was like, is it like a bear with beetle legs? Or I just imagined the mixture of like a Hercules beetle and a bear, which would be pretty cool, but is not what these things are at all.
No, they're considered to be one of the largest of the goblinoids.
Yeah.
If not the largest of the goblinoids. And in your particular case, with that particular scenario in Steric and the raiding parties of bugbears, I had to create a scenario where it made sense for there to be such a large number of them. So the demon bear.
Yeah, I remember the demon bear.
was literally a bugbear that was possessed by a spirit from the underworld. I use that phrase actually literally as almost bait to see if anybody would take it. He was literally a demon bear.
Yeah.
He had a demon inside the bugbear who was possessing it, and it would use its powers to basically turn the bugbears from small raiding packs into essentially a small army.
Yeah.
That was tearing through the countryside, and nobody knew what to do with it because nobody understood it.
Yeah, and that's not natural for a bugbear.
No. And that's when you sort of scale up your encounters because of the level of the party that you're playing or the complexity of the game that you want to create. I mean, they had even captured the harpies.
Yeah.
And then,
so much going on with this one.
Yeah, there was. And by design, because I wanted to throw in enough curves and enough things to make it interesting for everybody at the table.
And you took like a very like two sort of throwaway enemies, your bugbear and your harpies. It's and you combined them with all of this extra story on top and made it so much more than just, oh, it's just a stat block. It's just a bugbear. Kill the bugbear. So I really enjoyed that. Before we get too far, though, I do want to introduce us. Hi, I'm Chris. I am your host for the Monstrous Monologues. Where we take a monster within any edition, we talk about the lore and sort of inception behind it within the real world. We talk about the differences in editions, and then we answer some questions and also take some time to like delve into ways that we think you could use these monsters creatively or in very interesting ways. I'm joined by my DM, Dave. Say hi, Dave.
Hi, Dave.
I knew you were going to do that. I was thinking about this yesterday. I thought, as soon as I say hi, Dave, he's going to say hi, Dave.
Yeah, but I have to admit, this is the first time I've heard the Monstrous monologue title, and I really like it.
It's a pretty decent title. Although, technically, there's two of us, so it's not necessarily a monologue, but...
We'll go with it.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. I think it works quite well. Anyway, back to the demon bears, the harpies. There was also a unicorn egg, if I remember correctly.
Well, not technically. So the original inception to the adventure was the gnomes having what they called a unicorn egg being returned to where it originally came from. And it turns out there's no such thing as unicorn eggs. Unicorn eggs are a myth.
Yeah.
And the gnomes were simply using it as almost a sideshow to get people to pay coin to look at many of the oddities in what was their phantasmagoria. And once enough chaos ensued from all of those circumstances, which was another part of the adventure arc, the gnomes essentially contracted with the party to return the egg to the mountain harpies, because the unicorn egg was actually a harpy's egg.
Yeah.
And not just a regular harpy's egg, but essentially a queen harpy, which made it attractive to the forces of darkness, and the gnomes had decided they had had enough of that.
Yeah, I bet.
And then they had the party take it on, and to get to the mountain harpies, they had to go through marauding horde of bugbears.
Yeah. Well, I think we had tracked down the bugbears because they had harpies.
Indeed.
They had some prisoners, and we're like, maybe we can talk to these harpies. And then we ended up with the bugbear party. And then I died.
I think there was one survivor from that game. He was the one that ran.
It was bad. It got bad real fast.
So not quite a total party kill, but definitely it changed the paradigm of the game significantly.
Yeah, all of a sudden. Well, we had lost our illusionist, I think, and that was the only thing that was going to allow us to get into the bugbear camp, get like the keys, talk and release the harpies so that we could have them take the egg off our hands, essentially. Mm-hmm. And then it was all gone. But since we did that, my cleric, who is not any of those things, had to go into town or go into the little camp and try and cause a distraction, which he did quite well. And then the demon bear clawed into him and threw him in a fire.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sometimes bad things happen to good people.
Raid was not a good person. I'll admit that. I'll let you have that one. He was hurt. You know what? He's one of my favorite characters, though. I really wish one of these days maybe we could revisit bringing him back to life or something like that.
Oh, yeah. Anytime.
Yeah. So let's get on to a little bit of history.
Okay.
And let's talk about, like, so what is a bugbear? And I have literally just, like, the definitions of a bugbear. So let's start from there and keep moving.
Sounds good.
Any source, real or imaginary, of needless fright or fear, a persistent problem or source of annoyance, or from folklore, a goblin that eats up naughty children. And that's from some website that has definitions on it, I think.
That sounds about like the same material that I've found.
It's surprisingly difficult to find any material beyond Dungeons & Dragons or, you know, like it's like.
Now, did you get a date on it? Does the material show a date?
Oh, no, I don't have that.
Because I think when I looked, it might have even gone back as far as the 1600s.
Oh, I have the origin of the word, I'm pretty sure. Or, no, I have the origin of the word bug, which I thought was interesting. So I have here, a bugbear is a legendary creature or type of hobgoblin comparable to the boogeyman, or bugaboo or babu, and other creatures of folklore, all of which were historically used in some cultures to frighten disobedient children. And that's just from Wikipedia. Like, that's...
Yeah.
And that's sort of what we're talking about today. But I would like to talk about how difficult it is to find any folklore where it's like... Specifically, a bugbear was the center of the story.
Next to none seems to be out there. I think there were a couple of mentions when I looked around, and I didn't print anything out. One talks about a, I think it was a peasant girl who was out collecting things like herbs or something.
Yeah.
And she gets abducted by a bugbear and carried off. And he's dragging her by the straps, and she cuts her strap. She gets a hold of her paring knife and cuts the straps and then runs away from the bugbear. And then that was it. that was all they said.
Yeah.
It's like, okay.
I couldn't even find that much. Like, it seemed to be sort of like, it says it's like a, the boogeyman or something like that.
Well, I think, and I don't know this for certain, but I think the name is probably pretty narrowly associated, and it probably did not gain any traction. It's like, we all know who the boogeyman is, sort of. Yeah. And that's a name that gained traction. Bugbear probably just didn't have that same appeal, and therefore it got relegated to the sidebars of history.
Yeah, which is where we picked it up.
And then Gygax or whoever decided to include the bugbears in the original Monster Manual popped it in there. And
according to what I found, it was Gygax that had actually added it in. But so on the whole boogeyman thing, I say the word boogeyman. You know what I'm talking about. But you may have in your mind a very different idea of what the boogeyman is than I do.
Especially if you're from the 70s.
Yeah. But everybody knows. Everybody knows like you say the boogeyman, you know what that is. And I feel like bugbear is sort of that same way, because I go try to find stories about, like, specifically, like, the boogeyman as we know it. It's not really much out there. It's just things you were told as a kid, or, you know, people told their kids, like, oh, don't, the boogeyman's going to get you. And then your imagination just fills in the gaps. But it's so ingrained within our culture.
Yeah, I think it's a really common cultural label.
Yeah.
That is not necessarily specifically attached to any particular thing. It simply attaches itself to whatever appeals at the time or whatever makes sense to the people that are talking about it.
Yeah.
So, like, in one of the modern things we have these days is Slender Man.
Yeah.
He's basically a boogeyman.
He basically is. And you can find a lot of stories about Slender Man. And I think that's just because he's caught on. So, like, yeah. Bugbear's just – they didn't. And
Slender Man showed up in the age of technology where every mention of him gets spread throughout the internet and done into movies and TV or whatever. Bugbears, I just think, are too far back there.
They just didn't have a chance to be memeified, is what you're saying.
Exactly. Yeah. But they've survived in our games.
Yeah.
Extensively. And the books we've gone through takes them all the way from first edition AD&D, possibly before then. I didn't look up the basic stuff. Through Pathfinder, through 4th and 5th edition.
Yeah.
And each
edition has got its own, like, they're similar in a lot of ways. I think Pathfinder is one that, like, goes way left field when it comes to bugbears as compared to the rest of them, with some different ideas, at least. But for the most part, like, they share a bunch of similar traits across the, you know, that they're primarily the same from the first to the last, although they do have some major variations, I'd say. Do you want to know the history of the word bug, though?
If you really want to.
I really want to tell you this, because I was looking it up because, you know, a bugbear is clearly not a bug and a bear. It's a really tall goblin-looking thing that may resemble a bear in some ways, but not a whole lot. So the word bug first shows up in the earliest English translation of the complete Bible, as far as I could find. This is from askabiologist.asu.edu. John Wycliffe, 1320 to 1384, led a group who translated the Latin version of the Bible into English. In the translated work, the first form of bug appears. And I'm going to do my best with this old English here. For we as a buggy, either a man of ragus in a place where gorgeous wexen keepeth no thing, so been her goddess of tree and of silver and of gold. I have no idea what he's trying to talk about there, but he says the word buggy.
No clue.
Yeah. In this case, the word did not mean insect. It was instead either a hobgoblin or a scarecrow. It was not until the 17th century that bug began to be used to describe insects. It appears that the first insect linked with the word was the bedbug, in fact, as these insects would quietly feed on people at night as if they had been visited by a hobgoblin.
Nice.
Yeah. So it's an interesting term, or it's interesting to know that, because when you start looking into like where bugbears came from, they were taking this idea of a hobgoblin and mixing it with a physical bear. And yeah, that's where bugbear came. So it would actually be more apt, like in our current translation, to just call it like a goblin bear or something like that. But because English is a weird ass language.
Indeed it is.
There's also a couple different differences in translations. So this is from ericedwards.wordpress.com. Connections include the Welsh for ghost, which is boog, B-W-G, and also the ancient Slavic word for god, which is bug or bog.
Oh, interesting.
So I thought that was an interesting way to look at, like, if you were to translate it differently, they wouldn't be comparing a hobgoblin and a bear. They'd be comparing, like, a ghost and a bear or a god and a bear, which a bear god sounds kind of cool.
Definitely. It sounds like they're creating a strong connection to the supernatural side.
Yeah.
As opposed to the fairy goblin side.
Yeah.
A more spiritualistic definition, which probably explains why it came out, I think, a little bit later, you said?
No, I have no date for this one. No, this is just a difference in translation. If you were to use the word bug in front of bear, it would mean something very different. Because, like, I had seen in my research bugbear called with BWG bear, and then with called a bogbear or a boggle, which is just another word for goblin or hobgoblin, that sort of thing. And I have one more piece of information. There's, as we've said, in the initial, like, in looking around this stuff for real world connections for bugbears, there's very little. But I did find one really cool thing beyond the stuff that we have here, because we got some cool stuff so far. Did you know about Bugbear Day?
I did not.
Yes. Let me tell you about Bugbear Day. So this is from bugbearday.org. It takes place on August 14th. Nothing I say about Bugbear Day after this, You should take it all with a grain of salt, because they made up just so much stuff, but it's worth sharing. While historical records are sketchy, the best information we have is that Bugbear Day was created by Ralph Waldo Emerson in 1841 with the publication of his essay Self-Reliance. In that essay, his famous quote of "a foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds" lays down the principal rule of Bugbear Day. It then goes on, this end quote, it goes on to explain that Bugbear Day is basically the monkey's paw, the holiday.
Okay.
So you give someone a gift, but you give it, it's got like a mean twist to it, or like a small prank that's associated with it.
So sort of an April Fool's Day with a sinister edge?
Yeah, slightly. Because it gets even weirder. They go on, quote, "one of the most famous adherents to Bugbear Day was FDR. Indeed, Social Security is what's just one big bugbear gift. Honoring his memory was also why the Americans pressed for the surrender of Japan to be on August 14th. End quote.
I'm sensing maybe a little bit of shenanigans.
Yeah, it took me about halfway through this like article to be like, wait a minute, I don't think any of this is right. Moving forward, because according to the page, Bugbear Day was banned for 50 years in 1953 by the Bugbear Leadership Council. So we don't get anything until 2003. Quote, "the first Bugbear Day in the 21st century was on August 14th, 2003. While it had been hoped that its dormancy would cause grand gestures not to occur, it did not turn out as planned. An overly enthusiastic bugbear of the hale age of 65 decided he would black out the East Coast, and so he did." End quote.
I think I see what they're doing.
So, that's Bugbear Day, and I personally want to celebrate Bugbear Day.
It might be worth doing something on that particular day.
Yeah, I think it's a fun holiday. It sounds like it would be a lot of fun as long as you kept it low key and you're not
blacking out the East Coast.
Blacking out the East Coast, just hurting anybody in general, you know. But pranking somebody with like a gift, it's something they really want. but you've got to twist it. You've got to turn that knife just a little bit and make it to where it's, no, this isn't what you actually wanted. So as far as like real world stuff, that's the most I could really find.
That's more than I found, actually.
Yeah, bugbears, like we said, like surprisingly scant information on like folklore. I tried looking up just like any tale I could find for like bugbears specifically. There's tons of goblins and stuff, but nothing that's like, nope, this specific thing is there.
And I think that may be one of the principal reasons why it got blurred also is because it is considered a goblin. And I think linguistically, in a folklore sense, it may have just been absorbed by those tales of goblins and such.
Yeah.
If I had more time to research, I might look for goblins of large size or, you know, variations on the theme to see if there are any, like, trolls under the bridge, so to speak, that could be explained away by large-sized goblins. But honestly, I think they've given us an interesting monster to play with.
Yeah.
In spite of all that.
So let's get into it. Let's get into some of the differences in, like, additions and some fun ways to use. Let's go way, way back. Start at the beginning.
There was nothing?
Yeah. In the beginning, there were bugbears, and God saw that it was good.
There was nothing but bugbears.
Yeah.
The big and God said, bang.
Let's maybe try again. You've got how many years of like D&D experience?
I started playing Dungeons & Dragons in 1980 as a player.
Yeah.
And then probably the year after, I kicked in as the Dungeon Master and really never stopped.
A lot is what you're saying.
I mean, there have been some breaks here and there, but
Yeah,
it's always been my probably biggest hobby.
It's a good hobby.
Yeah.
And you're the reason that I got into it.
Yeah, I'm so sorry.
No, I appreciate it. But you know, I remember going up to your table and being like, hey, I know one of your players just moved away. Can I jump in that spot? Maybe. But let's go back. Like, tell me about the first bugbear.
So in what I've read and what probably translates well into the editions is that they're basically an offshoot of goblin kind.
Yeah.
And what I read in one of these books somewhere.
Yeah, we've got a stack of books for the listeners, like from the Advanced D&D First Monster Manual up to 5th edition. We've got some Pathfinder and a smattering of other things, Volo's Guide, the 2nd edition Complete Book of Villains. We've got some stuff here.
Yeah, we did our research.
Yeah.
But one of them talks about how at one time the bugbears were just like children of goblins that were born different. So they're really like putting in evolutionary theory into Dungeons & Dragons. And that's where it's rumored that they came from, but they certainly became something more than that.
Yeah.
So the first bugbear would likely have been just an odd duck goblinoid who grew larger and more powerful and presumably got a lot meaner.
Yeah.
And once he figured out he was the biggest and the baddest, he kind of proceeded from there. So a lot of times you might see bugbears with regular goblin thralls or servants running whatever they want to do and surviving as best they can in whatever environment the game master puts them in. But the first ones, I think, would have just been these sort of mutants, for lack of a better term, that turned out to be bigger, stronger, a little bit more solitary from what I'm reading.
Yeah, I think they did, if memory serves, like Pathfinder had the same basic concept.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, bugbears weren't always. And so they were born from goblinoids or just regular goblins and then were way too violent to keep around. And so sort of like outcast.
Yeah, pretty much. I could definitely see that. Now, depending on how you wanted to structure it as a GM, how you wanted to work them into your campaign's mythology, you could say they were a curse on goblin kind, You could say that the goblin gods wished something more powerful than the goblins they had would rise up and made them become bugbears. And
it could be sort of like the monkey's paw, like we're just talking about, where they wanted this one thing and they got exactly what they wanted.
And it didn't work out how they planned.
No, not at all. Goblins get the short end of the stick when it comes to bugbears.
Yeah, they really do. It's a dog-eat-dog world in Dungeons & Dragons.
Buried bears. Yeah, I mean, you've got to have that. So, like, are there any, like, defining, like, characteristics of, like, first edition bugbears? Something that, like, sets them apart from your typical bugbear, or the way that people think of bugbears these days?
So, really, their solitary, stealthy nature, I think, was really telling. Other goblins can be that way, but they aren't often played that way. I think it was emphasized more in the bugbear than you would normally see it. One of the books that we have is The Complete Book of Humanoids, which is an Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 2nd Edition book. And on page 21, it talks about bugbears. And it talks about class restrictions. And they can go up to 12th level fighter, 8th level cleric, 5th level shaman, 5th level witch doctor, and 9th level thief.
Oh, yeah.
Which is fairly significant. And if you look at the stats as they're given, they don't tend to travel in anything but small groups. Only when they're coalesced together by a larger force.
Yeah.
Or browbeaten, as you will, to be part of somebody's army. Do you ever see large masses of them? So I could very easily see a group of bugbears menacing a small village or a farmstead, and it becomes quite the horror story. I mean, I'm kind of surprised there's not a movie out there called Bugbears, because I think it would be interesting.
We maybe should have.
I mean, there's some on trolls, and there's some on all these other creatures.
Yeah.
Even leprechauns.
There's like 90 of those.
I just don't think these guys ever mainstreamed, and I actually think there's some potential there. I mean, we just had a horror movie come out where if you made a sound, the monsters would come and eat you.
Yeah.
Or kill you, or whatever they did. And that was fairly significant. And those were monsters that came out of the blue, and bugbears actually have like a legacy and a history to them.
Yeah, they've been around for a while. Speaking of like sizes, I wanted to that made me think of in second edition. I love the what do they call it, like Gygaxian ecology or something like that, where the one thing that Gygax was very good about was making sure that your monster felt like grounded within the real world.
Yes.
And making it to where he would tell you things like how many children of this particular monster would be in a cave that you found them in. And it says like the biggest, or not necessarily the biggest, but the biggest group of bugbears that they give in the second edition monster manual was only 24. So if 24 or more bugbears are encountered, they will have a chief in addition to their leaders. Like, so you can imagine if that's what it takes to get a chief, they're not going to get much bigger than that.
Oh, definitely not.
Yeah. 24 is a lot for bugbears.
Not unless you want to write them differently for some reason. And that's one thing to always remember is, they're called rules, but they're really guidelines.
Yeah.
And when you want to deviate them out, you certainly have that capacity. So if you have a small group and want them to face off against a small group of bugbears, and you don't even have to call them bugbears.
Yeah.
You could call them night goblins or...
Ooh, that's good. I like night goblins.
Something, you know, equally mysterious.
Yeah.
Find a name that fits your game.
Yeah.
And that will invoke in your players the right sense of mystery and dread.
Yeah.
And go with that. The less you use the game rules... which most players are incredibly familiar with.
At this point, for sure.
Yeah, the better you are, because they have to go through the mental hoops of putting it together. just based on the descriptions.
Yeah.
And you can even change the descriptions. The fur color can change. The skin color can change.
Instead of saying, you walk in the cave and there's a bugbear. You know, you walk in the cave and in there is standing a ferocious beast, humanoid. It's got long black hair that's flowing off it and like a terrible molt. And its growl is unearthly, and then it charges you. It's, what is this thing? I have never heard of this. Well, it's just a bugbear. Yep. You don't know that, you know? So that's always a good way to go about it. I like that. Just take away the actual name of the creature and then let them try and figure it out.
Indeed. Yeah, definitely. And especially if you've worked in like your own local legends.
Yeah.
You can build on that and just let them try to figure out what it is.
Well, you know, I do want to talk about that because you brought up when in our sort of like cold open there, the idea of having a bugbear like haunting a village and just having like one or maybe two.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like we could expand upon that considerably.
Sure.
Let's talk about some good legends you could have within that town. Concerning the bugbear, because you could do things like these bugbears. Bugbears don't live all that long. They live comparable to humans, a little bit less, I believe, in most editions. But you could have them have been there for like different generations of them for years and years, making the legends very different. So some people say it has yellow eyes. Grant, you know. Old man Jenkins says it has yellow eyes, but the toddler down the street says it has red eyes because they're two very, you know, like they're very separate.
Is old man entities. Jenkins' first name Leroy?
Yes, it is. but you know, old man Leroy Jenkins says it has yellow eyes, but he also like he may know more about what it actually is. Maybe he's actually seen it a couple times. I don't know. I just wanted to expand upon it.
Do you want to set the scene?
Let's see. So you come into a town and the town is, it seems to be not much different than your normal village with a few major exceptions. They have like a statue or like several scarecrows around the town that, you haven't seen this in any other place. They also have in front of the scarecrows, like, small offering bowls. So, like, with some with, like, rotten fruit, some with some meat, some with a little bit of gold. And in asking about this, the townsfolk tell you about the terrible beast that lives in the woods. I feel like that'd be a cool way to introduce, I mean, because it's an immediate, like, you don't have to go ask the barkeep, hey, heard any rumors lately? You walk into town, there's scarecrows all over the place. Or just outside the perimeter of town.
Definitely.
That, you know, everybody in town would know about that. Would be able to tell you at least, you know, like from old man Jenkins to little Tim down the street would be able to tell you enough about the bugbear to figure out, hey, maybe there's a quest we can go on to go rid them of this terrible beast. It also gives the impression that it is much stronger than it is. Because your normal villager wouldn't be able to take on a bugbear anyway.
Oh, not at all.
So to them, it seems like something insurmountable.
Except for maybe Old Man Jenkins.
Old Man Jenkins has got some stuff going on. You don't go into Old Man Jenkins' hut. You don't talk about Old Man Jenkins' hut.
And you don't take his carrots.
You don't. None of it. Stay out of his cabbage patch.
No, I like it. So one of the principal things that I'll look at before I even play around too much with the monster, although I do like your setup for the monster, is the terrain.
Okay.
What does the monster have to work with?
Yeah.
And that's probably one of the first things is the terrain. So you're looking at, we've got woods. We've probably got a good sized creek nearby that the village uses for a water source and such.
Definitely a cave somewhere.
Well, I'm thinking some foothills on the other side of the forest where at one time there might have been a mine, but that mine, which is the reason the village was here, has long since been mined out.
Yeah.
So now it's just mysterious and spooky caves. And then if you remember in our open, I think I talked about how it may only come out on moonless nights or when it's very overcast. So part of what the group would have to do is to figure out the logic behind it and what's going on. The you know, what are the beats to this story? How are these things happening? What's the timeline?
And how do we lead it out once we get that idea?
Indeed. And then what's going to get the adventurers involved? That's the next thing, is the hook.
Yeah. Why do we care?
We haven't even gotten to the monsters yet.
Yeah. So what do you think would be a good hook for this one?
Most of the time, what I attempt to do is create hooks that play off the characters themselves and the backgrounds that the players have developed. So what if the whole reason for the players being here in the first place, for their characters running around this town, is to find something that was once at the old chapel?
Yeah.
Because almost every town is going to have a church, at least one.
Yeah.
In a monotheistic setting, that would probably be a, you know, European Christian church of some rural nature. In most game settings, it's one of the polytheistic gods that hold favor in whatever kingdom or realm you're in. So it could be a church of Pelor. It could be a church to the druidic gods.
Yeah.
Whatever fits.
Pick one. Bahamut, Rayo.
Yep. Whatever fits and what makes sense. But then when you get there to, you know, retrieve this bit of information or whatever, you find out that, the priest dude or priestess or whoever's supposed to be there is also one of the missing. Now, why he's missing might be a mystery that you have to solve. It could be a couple of reasons. He could simply be out and about looking for someone else that's missing. He could be out doing his seasonal gathering of herbs so that he can have them to help heal townsfolk and things of that nature. Or he might be out in the forest setting up wards and traps to catch the monster. He might be trying to do the same thing the adventurers are going to image.
Or he could have been caught by the monster himself.
Well, I mean, that's probably where it's going to end up.
It's probably going to be a bunch of bones. Maybe. We'll see.
Well, if you read the bugbear descriptions, they do like to eat.
Yeah, and they're not very merciful. Like, unless they're going to get something out of it, there's not really a good reason for them to spare anyone's lives.
Yeah, you basically – I always view them as having sort of an alpha mentality.
Yeah.
And unless you can be a bigger alpha, you're lunch.
Yeah. That's a good way to look at it. Yeah.
Kind of, sort of. Piss them off and they're just going to eat you.
Of course, you could always bring in, like, maybe there is a little bit of help from the priest's god that has allowed them to survive this long. They don't always just have to be dead.
Possibly.
Yeah.
Now, if you want to add a more supernatural element and say, what if bugbears could be turned or at least bothered by holy symbols and such? And that's the reason that they don't typically attack certain people or raid the chapel itself.
Yeah.
They may raid the outside houses, but then they don't go on holy ground or anything like that.
Yeah.
But ultimately, it depends on the tone that you want to put into your game and the type of mythology you want to put into your game.
And if you were going with the Slavic, those other translations I brought up, like, that's very easy. Like, there's Ghost Bugbear does not want to, you know, screw around with the priest. Not very much.
And it may not even be ghost. It may be the fact that it is simply a supernatural creature.
Yeah.
A lot of times in folklore, no supernatural creature would cross the line of holy ground.
Yeah.
Without getting damaged, be it werewolf, goblin, whatever. It didn't matter because, especially in a Christian mythos, they were all considered creatures of the underworld on some level. In your campaign, it could be something similar. It may simply be that the god of the sun does not appreciate these night creatures, and so therefore his turning effects work against them also.
Yeah, that would be an interesting way to look at bugbears, having the ability to turn them as well.
Well, it says they're, you know, goblin kind. Now, in our modernistic gaming take, goblins are a physical species, and they have evolution and all of that stuff.
Yeah.
And they're creatures of the worlds, the fantasy worlds anyway, that we're in. In folklore, they're supernatural creatures.
Yeah, for sure.
So that's a whole different tone that you could potentially put in your game. There's one game book that I always wanted to get, but I never got my hands on it. And it's just called Grimm. Mm-hmm. And it's basically Grimm's Fairy Tales. And a side company put it out very briefly.
Yeah.
And then it disappeared. And then it became very expensive. But it was playing games like that. You were playing, you know, Hansel and Gretel against the witches or
that sounds great.
Those types of things. And it dealt with, you know, the fairy forest was far bigger and more complex and more dangerous. And you can certainly use Dungeons and Dragons to create that kind of environment. And then the bugbears kind of become your middle hitter. They're not your goblins. They're not the easy things to get rid of.
Yeah.
They're in the middle there and they're sort of, you know, working up with your party. And if you remember back to the Book of Humanoids, they can get some levels.
Yeah.
So your bugbear chieftains or witch doctors can be actually a significant threat for probably anywhere from third to fifth level characters.
If there's no reason that they couldn't wield magic, that they couldn't have some like, if you were to give them, like, necromantic magic in one way, like, they would be actually able to summon, like, the skeletons and things around them to fight against the party, which I think would be a fun take on once they finally figure out, oh, it's just a bugbear. You're like, no, it's not just a bugbear. No.
Or inversely, you say, well, yeah, it is just a bugbear. My bugbear.
Yes. So it casts Raise Dead. Six skeletons pop out of the ground. What now?
A lot of times when I play humanoids in the game, I will put a material component bias on their magics, and you'll often see that their shaman or witch doctors have skulls packed with material that they use to trigger fireballs or bone staves that they use to conjure things with. Almost everything is sort of connected back to some material component piece, which is often ignored in regular gameplay.
Yeah.
And even I mostly ignore it in regular gameplay. I scaled that up to the point where I use it to modify spells and change them. But for the lower level casting of like ritual magics and shamanistic magics, it's all very connected to the real world. So a bugbear shaman might have a corrupt glade or something where he's growing, you know, sour seeds, which can be magic missiles,
yeah,
or a pool of brine water, which can be used to create poisons and all of these types of things, almost like an anti-druid.
Yeah.
I
think a bugbear fits anti-druid very well.
So there's a lot of potential in these characters if you want to take the steps to make them really good villains.
Yeah.
And one of the books I even brought for second edition was The Complete Book of Villains.
I need to just read through the whole thing, I think. That sounds like my kind of book.
It's pretty gnarly. It really tells you, gives you ways to improve your thought processes behind encounters. You still want to have those hack and slash encounters in your game because really they're just fun.
Yeah, sometimes it's just cool to beat up some enemies.
But you also want to have those boss encounters, and those boss encounters should have complexity and nuance and depth that make the characters, the players, scratch their heads and go, huh.
Yeah. And I mean, throwing in having a bugbear be that complex thing is really going to throw them for a bit of a twist.
Especially if, say, yeah, they're chaotic or something, but what if your party, one of their first meetings with a bugbear is actually in town and you discover that he works for a mercenary company? And he's one of their collectors or something.
Ooh, I like that as like a bruiser. They just send him out like, oh, go break some kneecaps because some people owe us some money.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And bugbears are chaotic evil. They would do that.
Yeah, they don't care.
Hey, that gets them food.
Yeah, they're probably going to take half the money anyway. So let's get back to some additions, right? Let's move up to second edition. And like I said before, one of the things I really like about second edition is just telling you like the children and things like that, that
uh-huh,
are within it. And
the spawn of the bugbear.
It makes a lot more like people don't want to have to deal with facing like, oh, it's a bugbear. It's like a 7-year-old. I don't really want to kill this bugbear child, but they put stats and stuff in there for it.
Yep.
Or they tell you that the young fight like kobolds, which I think it's perfect. But it talks about the females and the young in the cave or wherever you're discovering
them.
In the lair. They will only fight in a life or death situation. And it also goes on to explain that the bug, like the ecology of the bugbears, like the males go out, they hunt, they do all the, you know, typically masculine sort of things. And the women bugbears are supposed to stay home and raise the children, which is sort of weird when you think about like a fantasy character. But also think it's worth mentioning that it says that they like they beat the children, they beat the women regularly in this universe. So taking like a twist on that, you could be approached. I was thinking by approached by like an abused spouse, sort of a like a female bugbear coming to you and requesting assistance.
Maybe.
I think it would be. So hear me out. Yes, it's a little quirky, right? But it gives you like that twist of, so, you know, you met, you know, Boudreaux the bugbear that went out to break kneecaps because people collected money. And maybe he's actually been helpful or something like that to the party, but then you're approached by his spouse and it's like a very big domestic issue where she's afraid for her, like her bugbear kid's life. So it, in this different scenario, you're taking what is typically an enemy that you're supposed to face, something you're just supposed to kill bugbears, you know, like there's bugbears everywhere. But now you've got to like go save their children from themselves. And I thought that would be a fun, maybe like a fun little side quest or something like that.
I think it could be.
Yeah.
It's a bit humanocentric for my taste. I see where you're going with it. I just wonder how many parties would actually take up that quest.
Yeah, you're right. Maybe they may not be so so nice about the but that would be, you'd have to give them a pretty decent reason to do so. And beyond just I'll pay you, because I don't think that the beaten bugbear wife have a lot of.
So here's my sort of switch back on you for this. Since bugbears are chaotic evil, mm-hmm. Well, so is the wife.
Yeah, that's true.
And she has probably tried numerous times to poison her abusive husband, and, you know, and probably drugs her children with blackroot to keep them in line.
That you know what? I didn't think about her hating her children. I kind of assumed she would love them in a, you know, a bugbear way.
There's maternal instinct. She's not killing them. She's just drugging them so she doesn't have to worry about them so much.
Oh, man.
And then when the husband just doesn't die, she goes to the party and tries to basically contract them to get rid of him.
Okay.
And now here's where we give the wife a little, the female bugbears, a little bit of their own spin. What if they're the cooks and the herbalists and the potion crafters?
This is true.
Of the society.
Yeah.
What if they have a little bit of that goblin lore that's passed down to them, and they can actually use that goblin magics, not quite to the level of a witch doctor, but maybe a touch shamanistic, to where they know the blending of herbs and the poisons, and you can just give them those proficiencies. Mm-hmm. And then the party suddenly gets a contact where they can get certain herbal potions on a regular basis at a really good price.
All they got to do is go kill this one bugbear. They got to go kill Boudreaux.
And he's just a bugbear.
But also, so...
And he may have kneecapped your cousin.
Yeah. Let me throw another wrinkle in that. Why wouldn't the poisons have worked on him then?
Because he's not as dumb as he looks.
So I like to imagine that she was successful in poisoning him. Hear me out. What if she was? She poisoned him multiple times, but he has some sort of reason that this isn't working on him. Maybe he's a little bit more than what he seems. He enjoys being the bully and breaking kneecaps, because that's all he really wants to be. He doesn't have any ambition. But it could be something along the lines of taking like the religious aspect of it. He could be one of like the blessed, or not necessarily, I don't want to say like the chosen one or anything like that, because that's a little too rote, but a little bit more protected by his God, or like watched over in some regards. So taking him out, it seems like it's going to be a great thing. But suddenly you've acquired the ire of a higher power.
Now, if you wanted to use it as a continuous thread,
mm-hmm.
definitely.
Yeah.
If you wanted to make it just a simple one-off, I wouldn't put that much detail into it. So there's an item in the DMG called a Parapt of Proof Against Poison. What if he just has one of those?
Yeah. What if he knows he's being poisoned?
When you kill him, it's part of the treasure.
That would make a lot of sense.
It's just a little magic item. But if you want to make it an ongoing thing,
yeah,
yes, everything you've said would be a fantastic way to do it. Because not only that, the gods might just bring him back.
Yeah.
And then he becomes like a bugbear revenant or something that starts pursuing the party out of vengeance.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
and they have to figure out now a way to kill a divinely spawned bugbear, which is not too many shades different than the demon bear that I put you up against.
Same basic concept, just sort of flipped in the opposite direction.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, that's the thing. You can take this material almost any way you want to go.
Yeah.
It's just a matter of what's going to fit best for you in your game and for your group.
I really like the idea of a bugbear paladin. I love that. It's just like a concept. He comes back from the dead. He's got a big sword and a big shield. He's got this holy armor that he acquires.
And then he burps.
Yeah, exactly. His sword looks a lot like a chicken leg for some reason. Weird.
If you really wanted to.
Oh, I would. Yes, I very much would.
Not quite my speed, but...
That's okay. We got the
everybody's got a
straight man, funny man thing going on here.
I prefer to think of you as jovially enthusiastic.
Yeah, exactly. Eccentric is maybe the... I mean, I'm making the retroverse, so my imagination has to be a little bit out there.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Mine's out there, too. It's just in its own weird space.
Let's make it more grounded. So the last part of that is, I think, not using the idea of the bugbear mother saying, like, oh, you know, like genuinely feeling like she's scared for her children's life or anything like that, but trying to appeal to the players like that, just straight lying to their faces about it.
Definitely.
That would be a cool wrinkle.
You can always, always lie to your players.
Yes. She just straight, oh, you've got to help me, my children, my abusive husband. It's had nothing to do with it. I've been trying to poison him for 6 weeks. And also, like, those aren't even my children. I just found them. But,
Or like, yes, they're my children, but they're also his children and his children.
Yeah, they belong to, they're the collective children.
It depends on how complex you want to make those social interactions.
Exactly.
And all of that is perfectly fine. But yeah, your evil characters should lie.
Yeah, I like that idea.
If you're telling your players the truth every time you speak to them, you're probably missing some opportunities.
Yeah.
To really mess with their heads and get them to say, ah!
Wait, but you told me the thing. Yeah, it was a bugbear. You believed it? Come on. We've played D&D before.
Do you even D&D?
Okay, so let's move up to third edition, which I don't have a whole lot of anything with.
Oh, I didn't even bother to bring a third edition book.
That's fine. Let's just move on to Pathfinder. Because it's basically third edition.
Yeah, they're very similar. Although I do want to jump back to second edition real quick.
Okay.
And reemphasize two things, two of the books I brought. One was the blue-covered rule supplement, Monster Mythology,
okay,
which I think initially introduced the bugbear gods. There are like three or four of them.
Yeah, so, in fifth edition there's four grand total, I think. Maybe five.
Yeah, I think three are statted, but the book also holds specialty priest information on them. So if, as a DM, if you wanted to look at that just to create a more nuanced encounter – there's details and descriptions in there that you can then work into the landscape of your game. Likewise, there's also the Complete Book of Humanoids, which basically gives you information in second edition to treat bugbears as a player character. However, if you're not going to do that in your game, you can still use that same information to inform and help build a more complex villain that you can then turn against your party of adventurers. So consider those resources and similar resources in other editions that are going to tell you more about it. Because even if you don't use the material as written, it can still inspire you to create a better game.
Yeah, it's definitely like we were talking about Volo's Guide earlier, and I love Volo's Guides, and it's got a bunch of the same stuff where it's takes you through, like, you could build a bugbear character, but it also, like, really delves into what makes a bugbear, at least in this edition, a bugbear, like what makes them different from just a tall goblin, and how you can twist that and throw that at your characters instead of being like, oh, more bugbears. We love killing bugbears. Like, yeah. Once you hit third level, you don't kill goblins anymore. You just kill bugbears all the time.
Oh, not necessarily. One of the things I like to do is throw a new descriptor on top.
Okay.
So you remember the harpies?
For sure, yes.
And I called them mountain harpies because I actually made them a slightly more complex form of harpy. They were a little bit more robust.
Mm-hmm.
They had a slightly more interesting hierarchical structure, which you guys didn't encounter, but you can do the same thing with other creatures. So you mentioned goblins earlier.
Yeah.
In one game a long time ago, I had the elite goblin guard.
Okay.
Their only bonus was the fact that they had somehow gotten away to create charged sling bullets.
Really?
So they were raining down sling bullets on a party that also did 1d4 electrical damage.
Ah.
And they were just WTFing the whole thing. It's like, where is this coming from?
Yeah.
And all they have is a little goblin shaman who's been making these sling bullets.
That's all he does, just burn spell slots all day, every day.
And you had about a dozen of the elite goblin guard, air quotes.
Yeah.
And they went to town, and yes, the party beat them
eventually,
but they paid for it.
Yeah.
And the goblins also surprised them. So they attacked them while they were setting up camp.
Yeah.
And then you just get this rain of hailstones coming down that start arcing and sparking everywhere and throwing in the visual and auditory descriptors of crackling energy and flashes of light. They had no clue it was just a bunch of goblins out in the dark.
Yeah.
And when they finally catch up to them, they're so pissed.
I bet.
That they just, let's say they ended that encounter with discretion. But that's the same type of thing you can use for these middling encounters. And you can flip it both ways. You can also make a seemingly more severe encounter not quite as threatening by giving it a weakness.
Sure, maybe it's got like a missing limb.
Say you have bugbears that are paranoid of fire.
That's true.
Say they've been in a burn situation before.
Yeah.
And they've got burn scars on them and they've healed and recovered from it, but it's left them with a fear of fire. And all of a sudden, having fire present may do a little bit of extra damage to them, but it also may trigger, like, intimidation checks or something along those lines.
Makes them afraid of you. You could also do, I think it would be fun, would be like a sickness that has sort of ravaged their small group.
Definitely.
So that, you know, even though you're fighting them, like, they're still strong, but they've all got the flu. And so you're just describing, like, their, like, mucus and stuff coming out of their eyes and nose, and they just don't seem as into it.
Or they just look rabid.
Yeah. Ooh, rabid one. Ooh, that, I think that would be in the opposite direction, though.
Possibly.
I think another cool thing, as you were talking about, like, small enhancements, you know, having, like, your mountain harpies, you could have even tiny things like having some bugbears that have, like, bark skin on them.
Mm-hmm.
It's, like, very easily changes that encounter quickly. They're just a bit tougher to hit, but then you can add, like, that fire damage, maybe erases their bark skin or something, because monster magic and regular magic doesn't have to work the same.
No. I mean, all those spells listed in the handbooks are just examples of one version of that spell.
Yeah.
You can tweak that any way you like in different directions. And I think it's important to play with it. Not only does it make it an interesting exercise for the game master, but it also makes it a mystery for the players that they have to take those extra steps to figure out.
Yeah.
And they're just not beating up an orc in the room.
Yeah.
They're beating up a black tongue orc of the Migard forest.
Yeah. And he's dual wielding battle axes he should have no right to be able to hold or something like that.
And his people are known to be powerful poison crafters.
Yeah. Dual wielding poison battle axes and he's just covered in black soot or some design.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like it a lot. Maybe he can also do a couple little spells with, like you're saying, like shamanistic. He's got a couple skulls across his belt that are all filled with different spells he could throw at it.
Potentially. Yeah. I don't know if I would mix and match that much.
Oh, no, they're going to die with this orc.
Yeah.
It's a TPK. It's a TPK orc. So, moving on to Pathfinder.
Right? Pathfinder.
Pathfinder. I printed out the Pathfinder stuff that I could find because there's some cool stuff.
They do really good work.
Yeah.
I've only played the game a couple of times, but I'm actually a Pathfinder subscriber. And I don't subscribe to everything they produce, but I get the big stuff.
Yeah.
Like, I brought with me the first bestiary, and there are, I think, up to 6 of them now.
Yeah, they've got a bunch.
And that doesn't even include the supplemental material. One of the supplemental books I brought is a small module-sized pamphlet, but it's Classic Monsters Revisited. And it has a number of pages that are dedicated to the bugbears as well, where they've revisited the creature and sort of expanded on it.
So I'm just going to read some of the lore here from Pathfinder. Bugbears are consummate hunters. They're every waking moment devoted to it. Rather than hunting creatures, bugbears hunt fear, going to excruciating lengths to wring every drop of fear from their victims. For them, terror is an intoxicant more addictive than any drug. Bugbears are the largest of the goblinoids, and while hobgoblins are tyrannous, evil, and goblins are selfish and capriciously evil, bugbears seem to enjoy evil for evil's sake, the best kind of villain, relishing every agony they can inflict with their victims. Bugbears are extremely stealthy in size and use this to their advantage as they play mind games, causing bumps and noises in the night and opening doors and windows in settlements. They normally escalate these games by abducting a target's loved ones out from under their noses, then leaving bloody hints of their fate, like knocked out teeth or a bloody finger. The bugbear then watches the ensuing terror before leaving the victim's mangled body somewhere where it soon shall be found. That's cool.
Now, that could be a Sci-Fi Channel movie right there.
You're saying, like, if we're talking about a bugbear, going back to the original idea of, like, haunting a place, that is the bugbear you use. That mentality of the reason they're here is because they continue to strike fear into the villagers there.
Yeah.
And that's what they feed off of. I think that's awesome. Because a bunch, like, most of D&D stuff kind of sticks to, like, their, these bullies, that sort of thing, but this takes a very different route. Literally eating fear is such a cool concept.
It really is. And I also like the way that they discuss sort of like the nature of goblinoid evil and how different types of goblins have different predilections and pursue things in different ways. Ultimately the same goal.
Yeah.
They just want to kill and eat stuff, but they have their own sort of identity as they do it. And I think that's really important to play up on because it, once again, helps you build mystery and helps you give your game a certain level of uniqueness.
Yeah.
And playing out the horror of it, that doesn't happen often. We used to have Ravenloft for that type of stuff. And we have Undead, which occasionally work if you play them right. But
they're more cheesy than anything else these
days. Kind of cliche.
Yeah.
And so an evil goblin monster in the closet sort of creature is really a nice twist, I think.
Something that torments the players. You could even put this in like a haunted house section where the players are told to please get the evil spirits out of this house or something like that. There's no evil spirits.
Or you could take it even one step more fun to further personalize it to your group. Have one of the players inherit an abandoned house or mansion or something.
Oh, yeah.
That they have to go and claim. And when they go to claim it, they find out there's something more going on here.
Yeah. It's haunted, but it's, you can't seem to find like any of the magics you'd normally use to expel ghosts or any sort of like demonic activity. It just doesn't do it.
Or there might even be some ghosts.
Yeah.
But what killed them in the first place?
Oh, no. Oh, yeah. There's good ghosts there. And they're like, nah, man, you need to get out.
I did a game session a long time ago in California, and it was one of those on-the-road encounters
Yeah.
So occasionally I will still roll random encounters, and I know they don't use those charts much anymore.
Well, they use them enough. I use them with every single session that I make because I feel like it's important. It adds some good depth to your dungeon.
They're traveling on the road, and I rolled up a dragon.
Oh, great. Congratulations.
I didn't want to quite go there.
Yeah.
So they come upon a roadside inn that nobody's around. They go around the back of the inn, and they found that parts of the back of the inn are just caved in and clawed away.
Yeah.
And they start finding some dead bodies. And they're attacked by the ghost of the innkeeper.
Huh.
And as they're fighting the ghost of the innkeeper, the ghost of the son of the innkeeper phases out of the wall and comes running at them saying, "Leave my dad alone." So they had to kill the ghost of innocence because the ghost of innocence were still trying to, you know, defend themselves.
Yeah.
And then they discovered a trail leading back into the forest. And then they find this tiny valley that is just covered in ice. It's a white dragon.
Oh, yeah.
And I was using a worm concept for the young dragons. So white dragons are evil. They don't really raise their young. They just sort of leave them.
Yeah.
So it basically created this area of ice for the eggs to sort of mature in. And once the eggs cracked open, these little ice worms come out that will eventually become dragons if they survive. And they found their way to the inn and they attacked the inn.
So did they end up fighting any of these
They ice did. Worms? There were a couple left. They actually sort of kill each other off.
As evil dragons do.
And so the young wormlings were still there. So it was still a dragon encounter.
Yeah.
But to get to that, they had to go through the inn, the undead in the inn. They had to figure out how to banish the undead in the inn.
Yeah.
Because they had to find the bodies and do a ritual on the bodies to free the spirits so they wouldn't reform.
Yeah.
And then they trekked back.
And that was probably a whole session off of one dice roll.
Or I think it was close. About two.
Jeez, that's a lot. Yeah. Off of like, I don't really know what I'm going to do here. Oh, dragon. Huh.
But I've done the flip side too. I've rolled like a random encounter with a druid.
Yeah.
In a city. Don't ask me why that was on the encounter chart.
It's there.
They come across his body.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's always a good way. I love doing that, finding like if the party is like really having a rough time, but I'm like, it's about time for a random encounter. I feel like in this, I didn't really have anything planned for this one corner that they're in, so I'll just roll, see what they're. And it's something that's like terrible, like say, like a dragon. I think I rolled like a huge war camp of kobolds once. I don't remember exactly why, but I'm like, you come across a bunch of kobolds. They're all dried out husks, though. Like their souls have been taken away from them, and that fed back into the main story. It took them from being like, because there's no way they would have survived that. They were all at like 2 or 3 health and they needed to rest. But then it really like, it brings together that story a little bit more down the road. So in this Revisited, do they have, cause I didn't print it out and I wish I had, they had a bunch of bugbear variations that I had found. There's a couple different variants in here, and I pulled it up so that we could talk about them. The cold ones, there's the Cardens that are just like they're extra stealthy, so they make very good thieves. The tropical ones, but there's two. The Slate Stalker, which are ones that have adapted to human cities and live inside the walls that are supposed to be safe and then hunt humans and other creatures to live inside of I thought that'd be an interesting twist to have, like when you say you roll a random encounter table, it says a bugbear. Well, why would a bugbear be in the middle of this metropolitan area? Maybe there is one.
I think that's when you're getting back to the fae side of things, where they are actually fairy powers, or somehow the goblin powers come through and they can do a little bit of shape changing or that type of thing to adapt.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like a bugbear that is used like alter self or something like that. Kind of, lives. I mean, they're just as smart as an average
especially
human.
If they're living in the walls.
Yeah. they've even got like paperwork on them and everything. Like, that would be a cool one. You find a dead bugbear, but it's got human clothes, human paperwork, and all that stuff on it. So maybe
he's a member of the Merchant Guild.
Yeah, he's a member of the Merchant Guild. Maybe you were hunting down, like, someone has been murdered and you're trying to find this person. You find a bugbear wearing their clothes. And I don't know where you would go from there, but, like, that would be a cool twist.
Yeah. Maybe the murderer found out his secret and was trying to use him for other nefarious purposes and blah, blah.
Maybe the murderer had something against bugbears personally, or just thought he was actually doing a good thing. Maybe they thought they were the hero in this scenario. But it says the rarest variety of bugbear is the Koblack. I think that's how you say it. Born dead and somehow returning to life, sometimes hours after birth. The Koblack possesses an unnatural affinity for death. They're seemingly immortal, and they can survive for centuries.
Yeah, that would be a challenge.
I think one of the things I'd like for this podcast is to create, like, by the end of it, have for the monsters that we're talking about, like, a real low-level thing, a mid-level thing, and then, like, sort of a supreme, this is a real bad challenge. And if we're going to go with bugbears, I think the Koblack is definitely we're already starting really high. We don't have to go very far to get him even higher.
No, definitely. That sounds like it could be interesting. The tricky part is a mechanism to weave it into the story to make it part of the ongoing campaign or adventure. And that can be done. Yeah. A lot of it depends on your players and what they're willing to engage with. But if you give them a fertile enough bait, they'll usually take it.
Well, I mean, like, something like that sounds like something to me that could potentially, so they're born undead, essentially, and they're brought back to life. That seems like a divine intervention.
Definitely.
Something like that, which may make them, like, the champion of this god. Like, I don't want to necessarily go down the chosen one route again, but, like, that may be the actual one that we go. And it's raising a full army of bugbears at this point.
So earlier you were talking about the paladin bugbear.
Yeah.
What if it's an anti-paladin bugbear?
Hell yeah. I am 100% down with this idea. And, like, maybe he's raising a legion of bugbears to take on different kingdoms to acquire, like, something that would allow him to spread his power to other bugbears, creating, like, an army of undead, unkillable bugbears is, like, his goal, and you catch him midway through.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
It's workable.
And that, I feel like, for high-level characters, that would higher levels, because you're not going to, you know, you get up to, like, 18th level, still, you know, undead paladin bugbear may not be as hard as you think. Depends on the addition, too.
This is true.
Yeah. If you're going second edition, you might be able to, but 20th edition, well, you're basically gods at that point.
One of the interesting things to consider is how levels work in your game. A lot of people talk about 18th and 20th level and that type of thing. I've never had a game get that high.
Yeah.
Never. We've gotten to, like, the 13s and 14s,
mm-hmm.
and that's after years of play. But some of the storylines are just as complex. So I would say take level limits with a grain of salt.
Yeah.
And really make sure that the measure of power of the encounters fits the challenge of the level of the party. That's something they could take care of, but only if they're sort of clever and they work well together. And don't get too stuck on stats. Because really, it's story is what you're after.
Yeah, for sure.
I think in most cases. Unless you want to do a hack and slash game and then just go to town on that because all the numbers are there. Everything you need is in there.
It's ready for you. Well, I mean, like, having this undead anti-paladin, like, you couldn't just use the bugbear stats anyway.
No.
That would not work at all. You'd have to choose something else to just wholesale replace it with and then give him some bugbear attributes.
Well, or you can just beef up the stats.
You have to beef them up a lot for a bugbear to get, like, because I'm thinking this is when I'm talking about, like, low level, mid level, and high level challenge. Uh-huh. This is our, like, if you want to make a bugbear a world threatening event, he needs to be this.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Yeah, And, you know, maybe he's not, maybe he doesn't have to be the strongest, but he is leading an army.
Sometimes beefing up the stats is only necessarily adding certain descriptors. So, for instance, with your immortal bugbear, what if he can only be wounded by weapons that are plus 3 or greater?
Oh, yeah.
What if he has maximum hit points plus 2 extra die?
Yeah.
Or plus 2 points per die, 3 points per die, whatever you want to grade that up. And what if
regenerating health?
What if every time he encounters, what if he's looking for certain things, and every time he encounters them and pulls them into his portfolio, he becomes a little bit stronger? So let's say your divine bugbear is actually looking for pieces of his god's avatar to enhance his power.
Looking to maybe become the new avatar.
The new avatar, exactly. And then as he gets those pieces, he becomes a little bit more robust, a little bit more potent. Some of those pieces might be organic. He might literally swap out his teeth for the teeth of the avatar.
Ooh, that would be a cool thing to like describe after the party has like tried to stop him, but they failed, is seeing him like just reach into his own mouth and just pull out his own jaw. Oh, God, we cannot take this guy on at that point. That's a real good way to say, like, this thing is not something you just screw around with, because he just ripped his own face off and then put it back on with a different one.
So there's one of the games I'm running, my Thursday night game. I've seeded a plot idea, which the players have not been keen to pick up on, about the relics of a dead god. Because they're looking to be a force for good in an evil kingdom. And this particular dead god was a god of balance. He was a lawful neutral god of war.
Yeah.
So the hopes were that his relics could be used to tip the scale back towards the middle, because right now evil is an ascendancy.
Yeah.
And I've left clues for it, but they haven't taken the bait.
That's okay.
Something for your high-level bloodbearer might work the same way.
Yeah, I think that's a really cool idea, just them collecting these little bits so that they become the new avatar of their god. Or even when Bugbear's chaotic evil, there's no reason he wouldn't think that he could eventually take on his own god.
Definitely.
If like, you got to the point where he had collected all the pieces, and that would make your very high, like, 20th level, if you really wanted to go that direction, campaign of, like, gods fighting each other.
Which could explain why the last avatar didn't stick around.
Yeah. So every time he gets all these pieces, he just fights himself.
It could become cyclic. Which is very mythological.
Yeah.
So that's not necessarily a bad thing. So I guess we're going backwards from the top down.
Sort of. Because we haven't done like a real low level guy. I don't know. We sort of
started with one.
Yeah. Our like haunting, I feel like, is a pretty decent like low level one, especially if you're only doing one or two bugbears. That's a really good encounter for a first or second level party.
Yeah. Then you can take the party back into the forest. Through the forest, they can get to the mines, and a clever bugbear would probably set some traps here and there, or leave his own scarecrows in the woods, say the bodies of those he's slain.
Ooh. There's no reason that some of those couldn't be animate, as we talked about. Like, if he has a little bit of necromantic ability, or
there's something in the mine that is giving him necromantic ability.
Yes.
So you don't necessarily have to make the bugbears too magical. You could put other pieces, other circumstances into play. Say there's a necromantic pool, and whoever sinks the remains into the pool and then pulls them out again, the body animates, and then the person that did that is in control.
Maybe it's only animates for like 24 or 12 hours or something very short. But I also like to think that if he's got access to this pool, he's probably got a couple vials of that water on him.
Potentially.
At any point in time. So that'd be a fun way to like mix up the combat where, yeah, you've got these skeletons that are just sort of hung there like scarecrows, except when he throws a vial at him on his turn and suddenly this thing comes to life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's perfectly viable. You can always use items and weapons and other things to enhance the threat of a creature or encounter.
Yeah, and if we're going very low level, like that's the most fun way to do it.
Yeah.
You know. Let's move to, do we have anything for 4th edition? There's not much of a difference in 4th edition, is there?
I wasn't a fan.
Yeah.
So that's fine. Let's blow on forward onto 5th edition, which is the one I'm more well-versed in.
Indeed.
Then, I like 2nd a lot and started in 2nd because of
so
you.
So 5th edition, is that Bugbears with jetpacks?
No, that's the Retroverse. They're called Jet Bears.
You're going to do that, are you?
I probably am now. Yeah. Bugbears with jetpacks sounds way too good.
Sometimes you just cannot pass up an opportunity.
I really can't. I can't help myself. It's a problem. It's an issue. So in the standard 5th edition one, they talk about bugbears in basically the same way that you've heard. Mm-hmm. About they're stealthy, they're big goblins, they're bullies is something they go into a lot. They talk a little bit about their gods, and I think we've talked a little bit about their gods before, but I think that 5th edition sort of like god structure, and it is a little bit in, what was the other book we were reading in 2nd edition?
Monstrous Mythology.
Yeah, so it's got a bit of that, but like they worship two brother gods. One is the god that like tells them to be like strong and champions and fight and take what you want, and the other god is like always awake and always watching over his brother, and they blame any time they have to sleep on this other god because they say that because this god has to stay awake all the time, he stole their energy to keep himself awake. It's a real weird concept, but I thought it was interesting and worth noting.
It's got a certain supernatural quality to it, which is not necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah.
Especially if you want to sort of throw a curveball at the players. If they have to figure out new rules.
Yeah.
And the fact that monsters may not be working with the same rules.
Yeah.
What if suddenly you have a certain sect of these, say the shaman mm-hmm. or the witch doctors of the bugbears, never sleep.
Yeah, they don't ever fall asleep. And that's
and they're doing the same thing that their gods are doing.
Yeah. Maybe they've been blessed by this other god and their vitality was not taken.
And it becomes a way that you as a DM can take the qualities of the myth that has been provided for them.
Yeah.
And sort of pull it back into the game and say, yeah, this is a weird, unique thing to these monsters that humans or elves or dwarves don't do.
Yeah. You could also make it to where it's like maybe they attempt to rebel against this god. Maybe some bugbears don't like the fact that they have to sleep. They wish they could just do conquest all the time. And maybe in an act of rebellion, you come across a bunch of sleepy bugbears, and that could be your weaker encounter version of them, is that they're all just exhausted because they've been doing like an active protest against their god to try and fight. But I mean, you know, they got to sleep eventually.
And maybe the witch doctors are taking their energy.
Ooh, yeah.
Maybe that's how they feed their magic.
Yeah, maybe that witch doctor is trying to summon the anti-paladin super dude.
Potentially.
That's a good way to start at a first level and then keep moving up to where you could have a bugbear that starts off like with a small, tiny encounter leading to a years-long campaign with just bugbears being the main threat.
And I think the witch doctor and his subordinates become maybe that interesting mid-level encounter that we're looking for. That is bugbears a little bit more structured, a little bit more powerful, a little bit more mysterious, but you're starting to, you know, get their mythology and you're starting to get other details about them that you didn't have on the low level haunting, and that the high level immortal bugbear becomes sort of the full personification of.
Yeah, that sounds great. I really like what we've come up with here today. I'm super excited about it. I think I just want to run a bugbear campaign now. All bugbears all the time. They also talk about two other gods. It's Maglabut. I don't know exactly how to say that because it's a bunch of consonants. And it essentially resides over the brother gods, and they are not happy about it. They don't ever mention his name because they don't like that. Basically, it's the goblin god is what that god is. And it's what, in 5th edition, unites all the goblinoids. Rather than it being like a racial thing, it's actually a religious thing. So because they all serve under the same god, they're all considered goblins. goblins.
Yeah, it's kind of like a, I don't know, bifurcated mythos that seems to start to splinter and go off in different directions.
Yeah, it's interesting. With Maglebliot being basically like the center point of where it all starts. And there's also Skigaret, I believe, which is one that they don't ever say his name either because he's basically blamed for the fear that a bugbear may encounter. So, like, if a bugbear is full of fear because they're just about to die or something like that, they usually go into a rage, according to 5th edition, or they, like, lose their mind for a little while, and they blame it on this one god. They don't ever mention his name because they're afraid that if they say his name, he'll show up again and take their sanity, essentially.
Yeah, here in the 2nd edition book, they call him the half-mad bugbear god of fear.
Yeah, that's about right. So it's not much a difference, and that's something I really like about, like, 2nd to 5th is there's a lot of crossover there in some very good ways.
Yeah.
Like, mechanically, they're both, I think, very different. There's definitely, like, it's all about higher numbers in 5th edition, whereas 2nd edition has definitely got addition and subtraction and a little backwards math.
Yes, in 2nd edition, we math.
Yes. Thaco. Oh, God. But
it's not like, a dirty word.
Listen, I love Thaco as much as the next man, but
that sounded sincere.
Thaco's terrible sometimes. Sometimes it's just real rough. Like on your normal, like lower level campaign stuff, it's good. But when you start adding a bunch of stuff in there, it's like I don't even know what I rolled. I rolled a 19. Is that good enough?
Usually,
yeah. But, you know, when you roll a 7, you're like, well, you bust out the calculator. It's a bit of a problem. But I like that, like, lore-wise, they have, or at least maybe more like story-wise, because their lore does vary quite a bit from in different places. But, like, they're both very focused on the story of you as a player and your world as a DM.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's a good direction that they went.
Definitely.
So that's really all I have to say.
I don't think the vicious experiment of 4th edition really worked out well for anybody.
It was ambitious and it was cool. Like I said, I bought the 4th edition book. It'll be in here, the Monster Manual, soon, so I can read through that and see, because I didn't really get into it. But it seems like it would have some cool stuff in there.
I'll listen for your head slap.
Yes, yeah, just like constantly like hitting myself against the wall. So we've gotten through all the additions. We've created three pretty unique encounters, in fact, and we've been able to make them, like, tie together in, like, a full bugbear campaign, which I did not expect when we first started. I did not think that we could create a bugbear campaign. But here we are.
Yep.
I think it's time we answer a couple questions.
Uh-oh.
And we'll start wrapping up. So, let's see.
I like chocolate and roses and... Wait, it's not a Tinder question?
No, it's not one of those. So the first question is from Sean Varsos at ThatVarsos on Twitter, and he asks, what are your tweaks to make them more like the Tenebrous Monsters of lore? I like the ambush thing, but feel like they aren't sufficiently boogeyman enough and would love some tips. I think we've gone pretty far in that direction in some ways, but like, what I would like to make him, like, let's make him actually the monster in the closet. Let's make the thing that scares kids.
So I think to do that, you have to, as a game master, add that touch of the supernatural.
Definitely.
Because it's really hard for a 7-foot-tall monster to fit in somebody's closet if they don't have a little bit of a supernatural punch behind them. And that could be even adding an element of undetectability, shadow walking.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. What if you mix their like abilities with that of just like a shadow? Like maybe they can turn into a shadow at any point in time, and that would make them significant higher threat for just like one or two people to encounter, but would also very much make them that monster in the closet. You know, you go to open up the closet and there's nothing there.
Yeah,
because he's just like slunk out underneath your feet.
And it depends on how detailed you want to get. So if you want to keep them as, like, in 2nd edition, I call them 3-hit die creatures with an edge, you might roll back to that witch doctor shaman aspect and say, what if they break into the house or do something along those lines and leave something behind? And because they left something behind, they can now enter that house.
Ooh, yeah, that's
interesting. And the only way to really protect your house again is to find that thing that they left behind and get rid of it.
That's maniacal.
And then for the purposes of, say, ambushes on the trail or something along those lines, they might just be so good at blending into their terrain and setting up simple traps that they might be able to confound normal people who aren't ready for them.
There's no reason you can't bump up their intelligence score and say that, like,
even
this...
I mean, even average people, I mean, their intelligence, their high intelligence is considered average.
Yeah.
Average people can do some clever things.
Yeah.
They may not be rocket scientists and they may not be alchemists or such like that, but they could still build a pit trap in the road and cover it with leaves.
Yeah.
They could still set ropes where they can catch people off their horses, or they can simply, you know, hide in a copse of trees or set bait, you know, a wailing sound in the woods that sounds like a woman crying.
Yeah.
And when the party goes to look at it, all of a sudden they're beset by a pack of bugbears who are using, you know, poison darts and vicious looking bone lances to, you know, attack the party. I had one encounter, another one of my dragons, always having fun with dragons. The party set up camp for the night and they set up a campfire, and it isn't bugbear related, but it could have been.
Yeah.
They start hearing this voice in the night and it's going, help, help me, help me, help me. Just a yelling in the night that went on for like minutes and minutes and minutes.
Yeah.
And some of the party was like, oh, we got to go see what's up. We got to go help him. And the other party members were like, help me?
Yeah. It's clearly a trap.
So I played to that, and the curiosity of like 3/5 of the party won out while the other two stayed behind. And what I had done is a young green dragon had dominated a tribe of goblins.
Yeah.
And the goblins were luring people into the woods, and then the green dragon would attack them.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
So depending on how clever you want to make the bugbears and what kind of tone you want to give your game, that's really what you can go with. And, you know, giving them stealth stats, you know, go ahead and roll them as a thief and give them the numbers that they need in whatever system you're playing to where you can adjudicate their abilities. And you may have one heavy hitter who is a level or two higher in ability, and then he'll have his gang or team that will essentially be hiding and serving as a, you know, backup or as the surprise ambush force.
Yeah, for sure.
But a lot of it is going to depend on how it relates to your players. What kind of bait are they going to take? So look at your players, look at how they play, what they're interested in, what their characters' motivations are, and figure out what you need to bait the trap.
Yeah.
Because if they're just going to ride by and not care, it doesn't matter what the bugbears do.
Yeah. If they don't want to fight the bugbears, they'll just avoid it. So you've got to make it very tempting.
Yeah, and it's the difference between turning it from a hack and slash encounter into something with a bit more mystery and a bit more oomph. Even if the bugbears were not part of your initial plot line, you could put something in their treasure that further seeds another element of your plot line. Say they find a sword on one of the bugbears that is a forge marked or has the heraldry of somebody that you need to meet up with in the next village or the next town.
Yeah.
It might be a king's guard. It might be a road watch. It might even be marked with a guild sigil, and bringing that in may suddenly become sort of a bargaining point that helps the party. So a treasure from the bugbear doesn't need to be, you know, a handful of copper coins and a vial of poison. It can also be something that gives roleplay significance to a future encounter.
Speaking of that, one of the things I did with a bugbear on that point was I had them have a map. that the player, it was important to the players. The players didn't know that the map was there. They're just trying to clear out the bugbears, or to clear out like the goblins and the bugbears from this small cave. It's really low level adventure. But when they meet up with the bugbear, he starts monologuing for a little while, thinking he's, you know, the hottest there is. He thinks he's the best. And suddenly, out of nowhere, his throat just opens up, because two invisible enemies were there to collect that map at the same time. And so what's supposed to be a encounter with just like a bugbear and a couple goblins, suddenly the goblins are scattering, and they've got two invisible enemies they've now got to fight in here. And it just it changed up the encounter a lot, and then offered them more role play opportunities down the road, and to find this new tribe of enemies that they were going to have to fight, because like clearly they have no compulsion about just killing anyone at any point in time. So I like that idea of like give them the just a little bit of treasure that moves forward with the story. They don't have the bugbear itself is like they don't have to be the most important thing in there.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
And anything you can do that enhances the game, and it doesn't even necessarily need to be directly. Even if you throw in coins from another realm that mysteriously are in your country when they actually come from a country to the north,
yeah,
is another curious detail. You can still use them. You can still spend them.
But why are they there? Yeah.
And then later on, some point in the game, when you've traveled north, you begin to recognize that people are using, you know, those coins that you're kind of familiar with,
yeah,
from an earlier encounter. And if you just happen to have kept some of them, all the better, because that will help you blend in,
yeah,
and everybody won't see you as a foreigner. But so there's lots of little tricks and elements that you can do to it. But I think going back to the original question of how to make them more sort of stealthy.
Costumes. have them dress up.
Look at that low-level magic spells.
Yeah.
How can your witch doctor or shaman enhance your bugbear party so that when it does its raid, it can look like something else or be something else and surprise the group? Can they use camouflage? Can they use trickery? Or are they just mean bastards that are going to be extremely cutthroat as soon as they jump out of the bush?
Yeah. Either way is good. I feel like we've solidly answered that one. That was good. Dave Folmsby, which is at Glistom, asks, why bugbears when you could use a hobgoblin or gnoll instead? I feel like it's a fair question. Like, what differentiates them from... Like, a hobgoblin is very militaristic. Like, they're very much about, like, build up the army, put everything together, and go attack in, like, formation. And...
Yes.
I think bugbears offer more versatility over hobgoblins.
Well, my understanding is they're a bit stronger.
Yes.
They're a bit burlier. The only time I've seen them referenced as being part of an army is, like, a special shock troop of 40 bugbears.
Yeah.
That they had somehow brought together to be part of the hobgoblin army or the goblin army, whatever it was. Ultimately, it really comes down to what's going to fit best in your game. When we were looking at creatures that were significant and usable, we thought about goblins and we thought about, you know, the basic stuff, kobolds. But those guys have quite a bit of press time already.
Yeah.
There's things out there like Tucker's kobolds and the Pathfinder goblins are pretty much a thing unto themselves. Really, they're a unique creation, which has resonated to the point where they're on T-shirts.
So you can use these. One of the things I think you're getting at is like people don't know a whole lot about bugbears.
They don't.
You can surprise your party with a bugbear, especially if you use some of the stuff we've come up with today.
They are the unsung hero of your monster manual or bestiary.
Exactly. So that's why.
That's really why.
Yeah.
It's something unique that can be a different flavor of monster.
So last question, and this one's more directed at me. It's Darth Loquacious at Main Moose Tracks asked, how do bugbears differ from the core fluff in Retroverse, and why are they so sneaky? They're not in the Retroverse. They have jetpacks. We've established that. Bugbears have jetpacks, so that answers that question.
There'll probably be more.
No.
No, just jetpacks.
Their lore is jetpacks. Their god gave them jetpacks. No, they found jetpacks And that's that.
That's it.
That's it. Don't need anything else. Do you really need to explain anything else beyond that?
Me personally, yes, but you go with what you love.
Okay. Well, I mean, Bugbear. Okay, so if we really wanted to get into it, probably they would be like shock troops for a larger military. And these hyper advanced hobgoblins had discovered that if you give the bugbear the ability to fly, they are significantly deadlier.
I like it.
Yeah. Some of them have jetpacks because they serve in the military. Some of them have absconded with the jetpacks that they got. And now they're just rogue out there jumping around like Starship Troopers and smashing down on people with their big clubs.
I like that too.
Yeah.
See? Isn't that fun? You take this little nugget and go, boom. Yes,
there it is. I'm just not quite as quick at it as you are.
I've had a little practice.
Yeah, just a touch. So that pretty much wraps up, I think, our first episode of the Monstrous Monologues.
Well, that wasn't too painful.
Yeah, it wasn't all that bad at all. I really enjoyed what we came up with. Was there anything else that you had, like, lingering in your head you wanted to get out before we stopped? Because I think we probably won't visit bugbears again for a long time. This is your chance.
So the only other book I brought, which wasn't directly gaming related, which I wanted to put a little bit of a shout out in, is called Writing Monsters by Philip Athans, A-T-H-A-N-S. And it basically talks about, well, here's the tagline, how to craft believably terrifying creatures to enhance your horror, fantasy, and science fiction. And it goes into a lot of details of all the steps of how to build it, asking questions like, you know, how big is it? How smart is it? What motivates it? What scares it? What hurts it? What senses does it possess? In what ways is it better or more powerful than the average person? In what ways is it weaker than the average person? And I think questions like those and more stuff that he puts in the book are really important to ask as you're building these encounters. Even if you're just tweaking them slightly from the profiles in the various books that you use, building better bugbears could be a fun workshop, but
yeah.
We'll go with what we have for now. And I would just say to connect it to your game, connect it to your mythology, have them make sense and not just be creatures sitting there on the playing field for no other reason than to be cut down.
Yeah. When you roll them on the random encounter table, like, maybe think about why they're there, not just, oh, they are here now.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, when I brought them into the steric environment, they were basically driven out of the mountains by the prevalence of giants, because previously I had started an Against the Giants story arc.
Yes, I also remember dying in that one, too.
So, yeah. That happens. But the ideology is that there's a background story going on that most of the players weren't aware of at the time. And the reason the bugbears were coming down from the mountains was because they were getting pushed out by the preponderance of giants who were coming to attack the kingdom of Geoff to the north.
Yeah.
And when we got into Steric, they suddenly became the really key threat. And they still are, because they weren't defeated, but they've also moved off down the mountain range a bit to get out of the range of this particular kingdom's troops and guards, who are now finding themselves having to fortify the north because the giants are gaining more and more of a foothold in the northern kingdom.
Yeah.
So think about how it can work into your game. Think about how it shifts the balance of power. Think about the rationale behind the monsters and then how even other NPCs will react to them and how you can make that a more interesting story that really captivates your players.
That's just great advice, just in general. I'm just going to leave it at that. So that brings us to the end of the episode. If you like what you hear, I'm going to do all the pluggy stuff now. If you like what you hear, please share it with your friends. Tell us what you liked, what you didn't like. It's a bit of a long-form show, and I think we're going to keep it that way because we've got a lot to talk about in each of these episodes. I mean, we could probably do a couple more episodes just on bugbears if we really wanted to. Maybe not the mythology of them, but I really like what we've come up with today. So tell your friends about it. Give us a rating, review, all that stuff. You know the gobbledygook. I'd like to extend a shout out to my patrons for making this possible, so that we can actually get the equipment and sit down and make this thing happen. With special thanks to a few people that have gotten the shout outs here on the episode. So Alan Michael Havens, thank you. Hannah Carlin, I really appreciate your support all the time. She's just a super cool person. Kevin Harris, thank you so much for supporting us. Patrick O'Leary, I appreciate you. Robert Harrell, I also appreciate you. And Sean Faulkner. So thank you guys for supporting the Monstrous Monologues. And I think that wraps us up. Dave, thank you so much for joining me.
It's been a blast.
Yeah. So for Dave and for me, Chris, thank you for listening. And we'll see you again soon.
So this is in Pathfinder, so it talks about scoring, basic bugbear description, names, Bander, Burshank, Bilgra, names for females, Sill Creeper, Scylla, Shadow.
Sill Creeper sounds like ones that would poison her husband.
Sniggletooth.
Ooh, really?
Really.
Fantastic.
Yeah, you don't get that every day.